You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Human nature can get a little messy, but nature is powerful enough to save us from ourselves. Seventh generation laundry detergent lifts away tough stains with a 97% bio-based formula. For when you think whipping up yellow curry chicken in white pants is a great idea, totally not speaking from experience. Let nature do its thing so you can feel confident doing yours. That's the power of Seventh Generation. Find Seventh Generation laundry detergent in fresh lavender and other scents at seventhgeneration.com.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
My kids love Doritos. I loved Doritos as a kid. Now I can't stand Doritos, but I think the only reason I can't stand them is because I'm afraid they're too unhealthy for me. So maybe I'm biased too much for some reason. But I was looking on Quora, which is like the Q&A site, and there are so many questions about Doritos. There's a question, why are Doritos so addictive? Why are Doritos so popular? Why do I love Doritos so much? Is there really a market for lady-friendly Doritos? Like, someone cares enough to write a question on Quora about that. Here's another one. Can I die from eating Doritos? I don't know if that's a question from a person who wants to commit suicide or is nervous about dying. It could go either way. Which one is better, Doritos or Fritos? They want to make a correct decision before they make a life choice like this. Are Doritos good for me? What brand of generic Doritos comes the closest? Because, you know, some people want to save money, but they still want the Doritos taste. And then I saw on Twitter this thread by Trung Fan, who also, by the way, you should follow him on Twitter, Trung Fan, just search it on Twitter. He's got a bunch of great Twitter threads, and he's got a great newsletter at Substack. Trung Fan, it's trungphan.substack.com for his newsletter. Ton of great stuff there. And so I called him, and Trung, welcome to the podcast. Good to see you. You wrote a whole thread about why Doritos are so addictive.
James, I really appreciate you having me on. I have to say I share your affinity for the Quora website when it comes to these type of questions. I can't say I have ever been personally addicted to Doritos. I do like Cool Ranch. That is my favorite flavor of them all.
Which, by the way, you know, is not sold in any other country.
Oh, is it? I know. I'm up in Canada. That's a great point. And maybe just North America.
Is it called Cool Ranch in Canada?
I don't remember the last time I had them, but if it was a little bit different, I wouldn't be shocked because I know the chips flavoring is often very different between Canada and the U.S. Like, we have ketchup and dill pickle, which are hugely popular.
Oh, ketchup and dill pickle flavored Doritos?
No, just chips in general, like speaking of flavors that are more representative in Canada.
Oh, yeah, like in South America, they might have like plantain flavored potato chips and stuff like that. But yeah, Cool Ranch is in America, and I think it might be in other countries, but under completely different names.
Right.
But why did you write this thread about Doritos?
I literally...
Oh, no, I just want to mention, by the way, you also host the Not Investment Advice podcast.
Yeah.
Excellent podcast.
Thank you.
And all right, I just wanted to say that. But why did you write this thread about Doritos?
So I saw somebody write, and I'd heard it before, and you know how they have these urban legends around kind of the fast food industry, and one of them that always comes up is like, you know, Doritos like perfectly engineered to be a snack, right? And I've heard this so many times, and I reread it again sometime last week. Can't remember what article it was, and I was just like, all right, I gotta dig into this, and I need to see what they actually mean, because with any type of fast food, like the intuition that it's engineered to be addictive, like that's not really shocking at all, right? Like, even in the threads, if you read the comments, there are a lot of snarky replies like, oh, wow, this guy discovered that carbs are addictive, right? Like kind of that snarky attitude. But it's like, Yes, I get that. There's like the superficial answer of carbs are addictive. I totally get that. But when I started digging into the Doritos thing, it's like the amount of like scientific brain power that has gone into creating this product is just astounding. And you probably heard over the past decade and a half, a lot of people bemoaning that the smartest engineers of our mind are getting us to click ads faster. I mean, you could talk the same about chemists, right? Like the world's top chemists are basically making things like Doritos. And Doritos is a monster business. I believe it's PepsiCo's second largest brand. So they do $1 billion a year since the mid-90s or early 90s. So Doritos has sold literally tens of billions of dollars over its existence, and it was founded in the 60s. So I just wanted to dig in a couple of things that you saw in the thread.
And yeah, because you got into so much detail about the chemistry also that I'm amazed. So, and then I did my own research. Yeah, I have a few things to add to some of your comments, but like, yeah, let's hit your, but again though, it's one thing being fascinated by it. What made you do a Twitter thread on it? By the way, your Twitter thread on it has 1900 retweets and almost 10,000 likes.
Yeah, I can give you the impression count here on it, but it's probably in the millions at this point. Yeah, 3 million impressions. But so to answer your question, I like to write a lot of Twitter threads. Twitter threads are great for certain type of topics. Like for me, my most viral Twitter threads, and I've had ones that will reach 10, 15 million people, which is equivalent to about 40, 50,000 likes on the first tweet. That's kind of how you gauge it, ones that can reach about 15 tweets in a tweet thread. That's just like the perfect length. That's like if a Dorito scientist was creating a tweet thread, it'd be 15 tweets. And the thing about this one that was great was, and it happens a lot on Twitter, as you've probably seen over the past year, is if you can kind of have something that is numbered, as in here are 7 things of why Doritos are so addictive, and this ends up being 6 things that I added, it becomes a little bit like a listicle. Like, I don't want to totally downgrade it to like a listicle status, but the idea is that somebody's scrolling through their Twitter feed, they're seeing hundreds of pieces of content a minute, and they're just like, okay, I'm gonna stop and actually read this guy's thing or this girl's thing. If I can learn something, that's what I'm gonna get out of it. So that's kind of how I approach it. I'm like, you know what? There's 6 or 7 things that I think if anybody read this thread, they can at least walk away from 2 minutes consuming this thread and being like much more educated about Doritos. And I've answered for them the question that, as you pointed on Core, many people have. And Twitter is, you know, specifically engineered to be a great viral mechanism. So it's a great way for people to potentially learn about this. And I'm happy to get into the specifics of it if you want me to dive into the 101.
Let's go. So, and you say, by the way, that Doritos are a good way to understand junk food in general. So it's not even just about Doritos. It's about all of these snacks that we are addicted to. And you noted a Colorado University study on food addiction that natural ingredients are often processed to be addictive, which, you know, you point out grape to wine, coca leaves to cocaine, poppies to heroin. Yeah. And you mentioned the analogy here is corn to Doritos. But I almost would say, well, okay, I guess this is part of processing, but it's corn to fried corn plus, like, you know, mega seasoning.
Yes. I think actually the framework you mentioned there is actually better than the one I introduced. Because actually there's a writer, his name is Mark Schultzker. I might be getting that wrong, but he wrote a book called The Doritos Effect. And it's in one of the sources that I dug in that I left at the end. But having reread his stuff, it's actually a little bit more prominent. And he touches exactly on what you said about the flavoring, right? It's not just like turning corn into Doritos. It's like you're taking the corn. So you're cooking the corn. You're turning into corn paste. And then you're chopping them into triangles. You're toasting them. Then you're deep frying them. Okay, now you have this vehicle to deliver, as you mentioned, the flavoring. And what Mark said in his book, The Doritos Effect, is effectively that flavoring is what you can consider similar to nicotine, and tobacco would be like the corn. So what makes smoking dangerous at the end of the day? Yes, smoking tobacco is bad for your lungs and it can be cancerous, right? But why do people keep going back? It's the nicotine that's addictive. And he was making the analogy that like flavoring is similar to how nicotine functions in cigarettes, which makes a lot of sense in my mind. I don't want to oversell these analogies, but I think there's a good way to think about the framing of it and to understand how, just like big tobacco, like big food, like the junk food industry, they're taking these ingredients. I mean, at the end of the day, they're trying to make money. So how do they make it as addictive as possible, right? And we're going to talk, obviously, through some of the points, but I think the seasoning part is a massive, massive part of it, which you identified.
And then after that, I want to ask you about the same techniques. Like, let's say hypothetically, you and I wanted to make our own, you know, super addictive snack. I think you kind of lay out the blueprint for doing that. So we'll talk about that next.
Yes.
But you talk about the obvious thing is your first tweet, which is it's this combination of fat and sugar. And in nature, you know, these things are rarely found. So when we as primates, as you know, if this was 20,000 years ago and we ran into something with so much fat and so much sugar, it would be like unbelievable.
It'd be unbelievable.
We would never find anything like this. Like if Cheetos grew on trees, we wouldn't have survived as a species. We'd just be all over it all the time. So, but what is the ideal combination of fat and sugar?
Right. So I wouldn't say I know what the ideal combination is, but I think you brought up a very good point about the flavor. Like the amount of flavor that's in a Dorito is just, would be completely foreign to anybody maybe 100 years ago, right? Let alone 10,000, 100,000 years ago, or however humans have been around.
Yeah.
But the Mark brings up something very interesting in his book, Dorito's Effect, is there's more gene, as part of your kind of DNA sequencing, more of it is dedicated to kind of the flavor and sensing than almost any other part, a function of your body. Is that clearly having a taste, the ability to taste things and identify flavors has been very important historically. And that makes a lot of sense, right? It's a similar, like how when you saw a certain berry or the taste of it was a certain way, you knew it was potentially poisonous, right? So flavors did impart some very important knowledge evolutionarily. But to your point, original question is, what is kind of the ideal mix of what is like, what should be fat, sugar, protein? I know that there are a lot of competing things nowadays. You know, there's a keto diet, and then there's some people like, oh, you know what, it's actually okay if you eat 50% carbs. But in terms of in the wild, like in our brain, if you were to introduce somebody in the African savannah 20,000 or 30,000 years ago, a triangle-shaped thing that was 50% carb and 50% fat, and they need to spend the rest of their day, you know, surviving, that vehicle of calorie that's in that chunk of a triangle would be extremely appetizing, right? So, and that's literally what the Dorito is. It's like, it's 50% fat and 50% carb, almost 50% carb. There's a little bit of protein in it. But if you look at other chip combinations, they're not quite on that level. They're in the ballpark. And again, this is not rocket science, right? It's like fat, salt, and sugar. These things are very, very attractive to individuals to eat, especially in the 20th century junk food economy. But the way the Doritos has done it, it is 50-50. I don't know if that's the exact combo that will create the perfect snack, but that's how they've done it.
And it's funny because there's literally nothing else in a Dorito but fat and carbs.
There's like 2 grams of protein. I think it's from the milk sugar, the milk powder that we'll talk about later.
Well, the cheese yeah, seasoning, the cheese must have some actual cheese particles in
exactly.
it. And it's interesting. I Googled what are the most popular snacks foods in America, and Doritos comes in at number 7, but it's the most popular chip.
Yeah.
I mean, number one, basically numbers 1 through 4 or 5 are all chocolate things like Oreos, Hershey's, M&Ms, which kind of naturally have a ton of fat and sugar in it.
Exactly, so, right? That's an interesting thing. It's not like the number one candy is a Skittle, right? Because Skittle would be mostly sugar. It's the chocolates that have fat and sugar because the fat has an extra kind of, you know, satiated.
Satiated. Yeah.
It's just like the fat gives you a little bit more, right? It's not like Skittles are at the top. It's like these chocolates you mentioned.
Yeah, it's so interesting, right? So if you think about it, pure sugar is not going to be as addictive because you'll never feel, you don't feel full from it somehow. So it's like you get full from Doritos, but because there's no nutritional content, the fullness goes away pretty quickly.
Yes, exactly.
So you want to have more.
Exactly, right? It's hitting different parts of your brain by having the fat. And I think, and we will talk about it later, but the fact that you don't feel full for long or it kind of just disappears is kind of the magic of the Dorito.
Yeah. And so, okay. So then, you talk about the cooking method.
Yes.
So, how do you cook a Dorito?
Okay. So I have, if people are listening here and you have YouTube in front of you, you want to watch something for 2 minutes after, just Google Food TV, how Doritos are made. They have a great video on it. But what I brought up in the thread, what I read in my cursory research was the fact that, and I buy it. I buy this claim that humans have kind of evolved a taste for cooked foods, right? Which makes sense. The entire purpose.
Well, sorry to interrupt, but you know, when humans invented fire, this is the first time in animal history, essentially, a living species could outsource digestion.
Yes.
So the reason humans love cooked foods is because you don't need as much money to digest. We've outsourced the digestion to the cooking process.
It's a faster way to consume the calories than wasting. Like if you had to digest it yourself, you're wasting calories to consume calories, right? So at the end of the you might have a net loss if you're trying to digest like raw meat from that you've killed and hunted. But exactly to your point is cook a fire all these tens of thousands of years ago changed the way that we were able to consume calories. So it's not shocking to me that over these millennia, we've developed a quote-unquote taste for cooked food or like certain compounds that come from the cooking process. So if you take a chip, right, what is a chip usually? It's probably just cut and fried. I'm sure there are other methods, but that to me sounds like how a chip is made, like a potato chip, right? But here is the cooking method for the Dorito. So first, they cook the actual corn. I believe it's just boiled. And then they mash it and turn it into a paste. And then that paste is toasted and then is deep fried. So we're talking like layers of layers of layers of cooking is going on. So every type of compound that comes from different cooking methods, they're rising up. I don't know in what quantities, but the cooking methods that are applied from whether it's frying or toasting or boiling, it's just bringing everything out. And
right. So and it's interesting too, because the more you cook, the less nutrition it has ultimately.
Exactly.
So first you're boiling it, right? Just to kind of soften it up. Then you put it into this paste, which also makes it easier to digest as opposed to just eating them regular. And corn's notorious for not digesting well, right? It shows up in your feces if you don't, mash it like this. And then toasted, I guess that means just heating it up so it's a little, so the paste becomes a little harder. And then what exactly is deep frying? This is a stupid question, but I don't actually know.
Well, actually, so the toasting actually serves a very good purpose. It takes out the moisture, because I don't know if you ever fried something. Mm. If you fry something with water and you're on a pan and you're not wearing a shirt, that oil is coming to hit your chest, right? It's like typically when you fry, you want something to have a lot of the moisture taken out. And that's kind of the purpose of the toasting here. So to answer your question on the frying, from what I observed from this video, it literally just looks like a giant conveyor belt of vegetable oil heated to, whatever X amount of temperature, and the chips are just flying in there. Like you would literally fry a rounded potato at your home in a frying pan in an industrial scale.
And so why does frying make everything taste good? Like if I take broccoli and serve it to my kids when they were babies, they wouldn't eat it.
Right.
But if you fry it, oh, no problem. They'll eat it.
Well, I think that's a great question. My non-scientific guess, because I didn't look into this specifically, but just from my own anecdotal experience and things I have come across is, well, A, the texture, right? The texture is such a huge part of it. You get the crunch from frying. There's no question that in broccoli, when you fry it, you're going to be a lot more crunchy than otherwise would. And the other part of it, you're straight up just adding fat to the process, right? There's that fat component that we talked about. And that's where the fat comes in on the Dorito.
I see, because the oil has fat in it. And so it kind of embeds that fat into the
Absolutely.
The chip.
There's going to be a lot more fat than if you didn't deep fry it, right?
And what's the difference between deep frying and frying?
Oh, that's a great question. I actually don't know if there's I don't know if that's a material to what they're doing. I guess just calling it frying is probably the safest. They're literally just putting it in an oil at a very hot temperature. You have pan fry versus deep fry. I guess the difference would be the amount of volume and what it's heated to.
Okay, no. So at this point where it's been deep fried, is this similar to just a regular tortilla?
It's comparable, right? At this point, it's comparable. It's just tortilla. And if you actually go back to the history behind Doritos, why was it invented? So the person that invented Doritos, his name was Arch West. What he wanted to do was take the flavor of a taco and turn it into a shape of a nacho. So you know all the flavors you get in a taco, right? You get the ground beef or chicken with the seasoning.
Yeah.
Then you get the cheese on top of it. He wanted to take all that flavor and turn it into a chip. So to answer your question of, is it just kind of like a normal nacho? It is. And then I think we are kind of teasing what the next part is. How do you add all the other stuff on top to make it more than just a nacho?
Because on the list of the most popular snack foods, Tostitos, which is like kind of the same process of corn that's cooked and corn mashed into paste and then corn deep fried, that's a Tostito, but it only made it to number 16. the real magic comes next.
Well, what do you got to do with Tostitos? Because you got to buy yourself some type of dip, right? But what if you had a vehicle that had everything on it already? What if you didn't have to dip it and it just had all the crazy flavors that you're looking for? Which, again, Arch West, former, he was a VP of marketing, sales and marketing.
Yeah, and you know, I know a little bit more to the story. So what happened was some restaurant had surplus tortillas. They had like too many at Disneyland.
Yes.
And they needed to use them. So that's when they kind of like fried it up and put some seasoning on it. Not what they put on now, but some seasoning. And there was like lines all through the park. And Arch West saw this. One other little tidbit. He died at the age of 97. Totally, you know, until his death, totally healthy. A month before he died, he was still at work testing the latest Doritos at his job. Yeah.
Dedicated to the cause. Good.
That was his life's mission. That was like his 50-year life mission.
Is creating the perfect delivery vehicle for flavors.
I've never Googled an image of him. I got to just see if he was like a nice, trim, athletic-looking guy.
Yeah.
Let's see. Arch West, Doritos creator, Arch West. Oh, he gets an unusual burial. I forgot to mention that because everybody dropped like Doritos into the... hole.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
Wow, that is interesting.
Let me see the images. It just shows up with the St. Louis arch, but I'm using Yahoo search engine, so that just shows you the quality of Yahoo search engine. But
well, let me add something to the founding of it that you mentioned. What was actually very from the top, we had mentioned the book, The Doritos Effect. They brought up the author, Mark, brought up a very interesting point. Is another thing that happened around the founding of the Doritos chip, which is mid-60s, was the gas chromatograph, where you could actually chemically look at what flavors were, right? You could actually distill what they look like. That came around the same time. So instead of him just saying, hey, it would be cool if I could turn a taco into a nacho, he could actually chemically break down what was in a taco and then step by step, start rebuilding it. What powder do I add? You know, what quantity of sugar versus salt do I add? So that all came up. The science of it really came up together with his ambition to make this this product.
And then, so then, of course, the Doritos chip has like 6,000 flavor enhancers on it. Like, what have you come up with?
So I'm looking at the ingredient list right here. And, there's a very shorthand recommendation that a lot of healthy individuals like to say is just like, you should just eat food with like the least amount of ingredients possible. Like a cucumber has one ingredient. It's a cucumber, right? And like an avocado has one ingredient. It's an avocado. But man, you look at the ingredients for Doritos, it's wild. And almost any junk food. So corn vegetable oils are the top two things. But then the flavor enhancers are where it gets interesting, right? So there is MSG. MSG is known to cause the salivation on the tongue. And when you salivate, flavors come up more. And as we'll learn later, it also helps mush the Dorito, which has a interesting effect, which we'll discuss later. Sugar and salt,
I have a question about MSG. So monosodium glutamate.
Yeah.
So you're saying it salivates the tongue. Why does like MSG on anything taste so good?
It's a salivation. It's to my understanding, it
That's
is a salivation.
The total it?
That is the core of it. Is like the actual. It makes you salivate, and when you salivate. I mean, I'm salivating right now just thinking about it. And and when you salivate, it breaks down flavors, right? And then things come out. And that...
I see. So the flavors that are in there are enhanced, like super enhanced.
Exactly. Well, imagine you have a dry mouth, right? If you imagine right now, literally just imagine you're eating a cracker. And then afterwards, you don't feel flavors flying around if your mouth is dry, right? But as soon as it starts salivating, which I literally am salivating right now, I can just start imagining different flavors.
That's so funny. All right. So MSG. And by the way, I had a guy on the podcast who's the New York Times food editor. Jay, do you remember this? He wrote a book called like Five Food Myths, something like that. And the first chapter, I think, was how MSG is not bad for you. It's not good for you, but it's not bad for you. It's like neutral.
Right. There was a scare about the Chinese restaurant syndrome, right? It's like every time you came, a lot of individuals would eat at Chinese restaurants because they are well known to use a lot of MSG and not feel well afterwards. Yeah, I don't know whether or not that is true. If it is a myth, then I'm sure I'm spreading a lot of myths right now as it is. So I'm happy to be corrected.
Jay, were you going to add something to that?
Oh, no, I was about to say, is it Stephen Gundry?
No, Aaron Carroll wrote a book about food myths. He writes a column for the New York Times, and he wrote a book about the five biggest food myths. And the first one was MSG is not bad for you. So, okay. So it's got MSG. What else has it got?
The other thing it has, which are interesting, is disodium, inosinate, and guanylate. I don't know what those are. They're flavor enhancers. I think they do the similar things where they get you to salivate more. There are actually some very specific things that make you salivate, actually. Let me call them out. It is called, I believe, citric acid is one ingredient that makes you salivate. And again, the salivation really helps bring out the flavor. Yes, it's a lactic and citric acid get the saliva flowing. In addition to creating more flavors or helping bring them out, it also triggers the impulse to eat, which makes a lot of sense too, because there's a connection between salivation and when you're eating. And then back to the ingredients, the last thing I'll add is all the different powders they have. So they have onion powder, garlic powder, green pepper and red pepper powder, and tomato powder. So as we mentioned, Arch West wanted to bring the flavors of a taco into a nacho. That's one way of doing it. Get all the powders of all those different ingredients you have in a taco, right? But what's interesting about that is the mix creates what's known called a non-specific aroma. And what that means is not a single flavor dominates. So you're eating the chip. You're like, oh, well, there's some cheese. I think there's a hint of garlic. I think there's some onion there. I'm pretty sure there's some onion. And what that does is when one flavor doesn't dominate, it doesn't make you super full. That's part of the effect of the fullness not being recognized by your body.
The body almost wants to get more full on these flavors, but it's not.
It's not registering, right? So Coca-Cola actually has non-specific aroma. It also is known for this effect, which is why, I mean, Warren Buffett is obviously an investor in Coca-Cola, one of its big. I think he owns 10% of the company. But he's called it out before. It's like, there's no taste memory with Coca-Cola. That's why you can keep drinking it. And I've gotten sick of Coca-Cola, but I know, let's just be honest, this place sells tens of millions of dollars a year of canned sugar, right? So clearly, this non-taste memory, this non-specific aroma of Doritos or Coca-Cola allows people to keep coming back because you're not sick of it. And your body's not just like, you know, pushing it away.
That's so funny because, for instance, I'll eat Doritos, but I can't stand cheese in right. part because of the smell of cheese.
Right.
But I guess I don't smell cheese when I eat a Dorito.
Right. Right. Non-specific aroma. You're trying to identify what it is. Could be anything.
Right. It's just like this amorphous food that has this intense flavor. And you're right. Tostitos, you need salsa. But here, between tomato powder, red and green bell pepper, and sugar, you've got salsa.
Yeah, you have no exactly right. It's there. It's on the chip for you to enjoy. And I think it's a perfect segue into the next bit I had was about the cheese, right? So according to the Food Network, actually it's either this or another article about the making of Doritos, but they go through 10,000 cows a year to create enough dairy for the amount of cheese they put on a Dorito. And this actually brings up the most contested claim from the thread. So I wrote that casomorphine is a compound that's released when you eat cheese, and it hits the same brain receptors that heroin does to release dopamine. So I saw this in a couple articles about Doritos. I got an angry DM. Wasn't an angry DM, but a professor of a nutrition or in that vein wrote me, said, "Hey Trung, I love your threads, but the casomorphine comment way off base." He said that you cannot physically eat enough cheese to trigger the same effect that heroin does. You know, I get that. That does make a lot of sense. But you should read the replies to that tweet, because it's just like, I think this guy's trying to challenge me. Like, the readers are like, I will guarantee you I can eat enough Doritos to hit the dopamine markers.
Well, it's interesting. So it's definitely – so I'm looking at it all on Wikipedia – we're basically scientists of Wikipedia. So we're Wikipedia certified scientists and professors. And it is called an opioid peptide. Apparently this protein digests slowly and it does act like opiates in the body as they enter the bloodstream. Although it doesn't say how much you have to eat in order to
get the heroin
effect. Like, yeah. But it does have withdrawal symptoms though.
Okay.
So you might not get high like heroin, but if you have a bag of Doritos and then immediately stop, you're going to have withdrawal, which of course makes it more
right.
addictive. And it is very concentrated. So the pleasurable effect is greater. So you do get a little bit of the effect of the pleasurable effect of heroin. So that combined with withdrawal effects gives it an addictive quality.
Well, one of the comments that I think we can semi laugh about is somebody wrote, okay, if this doctor that DM'd you believes that Doritos are not addictive, why don't you put one chip in front of him and then put like a bear trap around the bag and see if after eating the first chip, he'll go after the bag. You know what? I am not a scientist. I'm happy to hear both sides, but there's something there. There's a there there. I believe there's a there there.
Yeah, no, I think what it is exactly this. It's not like shooting up heroin in an alley, but it has all the same effects on the body, but just at a reduced level.
Right.
So there's an addictive quality and, you know, it might lead to some kind, you know, what happens with withdrawal? You get some kind of anxiety, you get some kind of depression. All of these things happen if you immediately stop eating junk food in general, but Doritos being the most popular junk food, Doritos in particular.
100%.
And by the way, I'm not accusing Doritos of causing anxiety. I'm just saying we're just talking about casomorphine. So, and it hasn't.
And again, in processed foods in general, right? As you said at the top, like Doritos is a great example of all types of processed foods. It's just probably the most extreme and easiest to grasp because a lot of people have eaten it and you can identify with, hey, look, there's this like chip that used to be a nacho and now it's just been bombarded with flavors. Like that's easy for people to grasp.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period. And I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs. And I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away. And I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Human nature can get a little messy, but nature is powerful enough to save us from ourselves. Seventh Generation Laundry Detergent lifts away tough stains with a 97% bio-based formula. For when you think whipping up yellow curry chicken in white pants is a great idea, totally not speaking from experience. Let nature do its thing, so you can feel confident doing yours. That's the power of Seventh Generation. Find Seventh Generation Laundry Detergent in fresh lavender and other scents at SeventhGeneration.com.
Now, let me ask you this, like, and this holds for the other powders too, like tomato powder and red and green bell pepper powder. Is the food themselves somehow in this powder, or is it like, does tomato powder contain tomato? Does the cheese in Doritos contain actual cheese, or like
the
just
cheese
some
is legit.
Sort of synthetic?
According to the powder, I can't speak specifically to Doritos, but in terms of flavoring, like, there are flavoring types now that are purely just made from the lab. It's because the science has gone that far. Like, you can create any flavor. You have the chemical compounds. You know the chemical makeup of it. And you can just create it in the lab. Now, whether or not Doritos is, are they using onion powder that has actual trace onion in it? I don't know the answer to that. But do they have the option?
You're saying chemically.
Yeah.
It's the same as onion.
Yeah.
But you're saying, though, the cheese comes from actual cheese.
Yeah, they use 10,000 cows a year, according to this one piece. So the cheese is legit.
Okay, so that's the cheese. And then your next item was called contrasting texture, which is fascinating.
Yeah, this is something we alluded to with the saliva. So when you bite a Dorito, it's crunchy. But very soon, as the saliva gets to it, it dissolves and just kind of disappears. This is not as extreme as a soft Cheetos, you know, the puffy Cheetos. Those literally just melt in your mouth. But that sensation of a food disappearing in your mouth, it's called the vanishing caloric density. And this feeling of food vanishing actually signals to your brain that you need to eat more, which makes sense. Makes all sense in the world, right?
Well, so there's so many different things in this food that make you want more. But I never heard of this vanishing caloric density, but it makes sense. So it's as if your body doesn't, it's as if your body was about to feed itself, but then suddenly the brain thinks, wait a second, what happened to that food? We didn't get fed.
It's physically gone, right? Like the sensation of having, because all this is connected, right? Everything's connected. Your mouth, your stomach, your brain. I know there's tons of studies about, you know, how the gastronomy of your stomach affects your mood and all your thinking. All this is connected. Yeah. What I will mention is the professor that was mad at me about the cheese and the calcium morphine claim said that the vanishing caloric density claim was correct. So I'm at least 1 for 2 on these claims, on our last 2 claims. So that was...
So you're halfway to your PhD.
Yeah, I'm halfway to my PhD. So there's that part of it. And I do want to call out one thing is a lot of these kind of tidbits about Doritos also was written by an author named Stephen Witherly. He wrote a book called Why Humans Like Junk Food. There's 3 books, I guess, I would call out. Sugar, Salt, Sugar, Fat, which you probably heard of. That was a big bestseller. Yeah. So those 3 books, these are widely covered. Like, I'm not the originator of any of these ideas, but the Doritos Effect, Why Humans Like Junk Food, and Salt, Sugar, Fat cover the processed food industry to a T.
So how did they make it though? So it quickly dissolves in the mouth.
You know what it is? A lot of it has to do with the saliva. And that's why the citric and lactic acid are really important. And all these other chemicals that we called out that kind of create the saliva effect. And that makes sense, right? Saliva is literally there to dissolve food and help you digest calories.
Ah, yeah, that makes sense. So if suddenly like there's more moisture, it's going to dissolve faster.
Yeah, exactly.
Why do you think we like the crunch?
The crunch?
Like what? Like for instance, originally this is soft flour tortilla, right? So why do we like the crunch better than the soft tortillas?
I think my anecdotal take on crunch is I literally just like the feel of it. It is a hard feel and the crunch sound that comes with it, it's just ingrained in me. I know that when I'm doing that, it's probably something I'm going to like, right? If it's a chip, if it's a fry, if it's a deep fried food, all those foods I mentioned, which are highly addictive and highly processed, they'll have the crunch factor. But specifically the Doritos, I think the contrast is what makes it interesting. It all kind of plays to the idea of this food memory just going away. It's like, you can't identify what's going on. It's crunchy, then it's soft and gone. It's got onion powder, it's got cheese, it's got tomato, it's got garlic. You can't identify what it is. Your brain's just like trying to grasp on what's going on. The entire time, you're just scarfing this whole bag of it down, right? So I think that's all part of it.
It's interesting. It's like, think of like a good movie, right? It starts off usually with some kind of mystery, you know, like Star Wars. What is this thing called the Force? How did Darth Vader get to be Darth Vader? How is Luke gonna find this princess? There's mystery. And I'm making kind of a very big leap here to make this analogy. But when you eat a Dorito, what you're saying is there's a lot of mystery. Like, what is going on? How does this tortilla chip basically have like, it's like, it's got all the salsa and all the flavors in the chip, and then it disappears. There's no smell, so you can't identify it. It's just filled with, it's a mystery chip somehow.
Well, I don't think it's a huge leap what you're saying, right? Obviously, you know, apples to oranges in the sense you're talking about watching a movie, using one of your senses to consume a narrative versus physically eating something. But at the end of the day, I think a lot of people will agree with the fact that we are naturally curious because curiosity was how you survived for all these years, right? It's like, This is why the curiosity gap works in writing blog posts and writing tweets. It's because humans need to know what's on the other side of it, because if we didn't 10,000 years ago, you're dead. If you didn't know what was behind the bush and you had no interest in finding out, you're going to get eaten, right? So the curiosity element, I don't think that's a huge leap at all. It's like, by having no identifiable flavor or strong sense that overpowers, you're searching and you're grasping. I think that's just very human and natural.
I love this final point because I wonder that you make, which we haven't described yet, but I wonder if they've chemically designed it that way. Like they tested something and they saw that, oh, the people who have this particular feature you're about to describe eat more than people who don't have this feature.
Right. And the last thing to pull the mystery back of what James is talking about is at the end of a bag of Doritos, your fingers are just covered in this dust. And I personally have one of two options. I'm wiping it on my shirt or I'm licking my fingers clean. And I have to say that it's the latter that I've been doing all of these years when I do eat Doritos. And according to the author of Why Humans Like Junk Food, that mix that we've been describing. So we've been talking up this powder mix now for 20 minutes, right? But that's like 5 times concentrated on your fingers. So you're licking that and it's just like the most...
Why is it concentrated so much on the fingers?
Oh, it's because it's just the powder now. There's no chip, right? So before it was like 10% powder, 90% chip. Now it's 100% powder. So that's what it is. It's concentrated versus eating the chip, right? I think that's what he was meaning. That's what he meant. It's not like it got more concentrated like versus the compound itself. But at the end, it's just that's all there is. And... it's a flavor.
How do they chemically design it so that it sticks on your fingers?
That's a great question.
Your fingers literally look orange afterwards.
Yeah, it's great. I don't know about that. I think that's more of a scary thing of it when you start moving into non-natural things. That's just a sign from nature that you should stop using it.
And then you mentioned something later on, like after the thread, eye candy. You said that researchers have shown that consumers are attracted to bright colors.
Yeah.
And Doritos have 3 artificial colorings. 2 different yellows and a red. And Doritos are pretty, you know, bright. Like you could, if someone's eating a Dorito, I could probably see that from 100 feet away as opposed to like if they're eating just like a potato chip.
Well, actually, now that you mention it, I never thought about this, but if you were to say, hey, what are the most, if you were to identify like from a branding standpoint, a chip or chip type snack. I mean, Cheetos and Doritos, top, right, straight top of mind, right? It's like, what am I going to describe as a color for a salt and vinegar, right? There's nothing there. That doesn't stand out. But like, right. Cheetos and Doritos, immediately, top of mind.
Yeah, like you could say potato chips are yellow, but they're not like bright. Like there's a brightness to that Dorito. And even like you said, the Cheeto. I'm trying to think what other ones are bright like that. Like what other junk food is bright?
In general? Yeah, I mean, when you start talking about M&M's, Skittles, those things are very memorable also. I think there's a naturalness to the Dorito, right? Because you're thinking, oh, it's corn. It's a corn chip. It looks natural. But you look at that thing. Those colors are not found in nature the way it is on that chip, right?
Yeah. So here's something interesting. Did you know that in 1994, the Doritos, they spent $50 million to do research about what people like and don't like about Doritos. And so they did a complete redesign. A, they made the chips 20% larger and 15% thinner, and they rounded the edges of the chip. And the reason they rounded the edges is because previously, you know, Doritos, like when I was a kid, Doritos had sharp corners, and there would be, just in the natural process of eating chips out of the bag, there would be too much scraps of corners on the bottom.
Right.
So they're basically able to round the corners so people get the full effect of the bag. And I guess that means they could have to put less chips in there to get people just as full. I don't know why the 20% larger has to do with how in restaurants, when you go to a restaurant and have like kind of salsa and chips, the chips are about 20% larger than what they sell in general snacks, or they were.
Oh, restaurant style, right? Tostitos literally has a bag called restaurant style chips because that is...
Yeah, and they're larger.
Yeah, exactly.
And so this was 5,000 chip eaters they did their studies on, and over 2 years, and they spent $50 million. And the other thing is they put more seasoning on.
Right. Well, I mean, this all goes back to how we started at the very top. This is engineered, right? It's literally engineered to be the perfect snack. Think about that. They spent 50 mil, but for a product that does a bill a year, it's totally worth it. Does this move the needle for them 10%? Does that 50 million get them 10% more sales? Well, if it does, they made 100 mil. So they made 50 million profit on that, right? So there's no question.
No, it's definitely worth it. And then, of course, they've introduced tons of new flavors and they redesigned their logo. They do all sorts of things. They must have spent now over $100 million on Super Bowl ads because they're in every Super Bowl. I don't know if they were in this last one, but they're in most Super Bowls. So okay. So now here's the question. Let's say I took a potato and I sliced it up thin, did basic boiling and frying. I made it like a homemade potato chip. If I did the same thing, if I now like put in, you know, I guess you put in the powders in the frying process. So let's say I put in tomato powder, bell powder, I put in a ton of MSG. I guess all this stuff gets wrapped into the frying. Do you think I'd have something? You think I could make an addictive snack?
I mean, I think you can make an addictive snack. Would it be a Dorito? Is that the larger question that you want to get to? Because I think a couple things now is, I don't know how you're approaching, but more practically is obviously 2022 is much different than 1965 or 1960s, that there's much more health conscious. If you came out with like the least healthy snack possible, but it was super addictive, I don't know how it would play to the market. But if you're speaking to just like individually, the taste of it, I'm sure you can get pretty damn close to making a chip like as addictive as a Dorito is.
You know, whatever, like, yes, there's the market and the market says that they're health conscious, but are they really health conscious, like most people? Like, would a kid turn down, if I did what the process I just described, would a kid turn it down? Probably not.
Right.
It's like the same thing when people say, oh, I'm not going to use a product if it's really bad for the climate. Unless it's something they really need, and then they'll use any product. They don't care.
Sure.
So, because like almost every product could be bad for the environment in some way or other. Like the same people who wear leather jackets say they won't use something that's bad for the environment. So, you know, I always wonder, like, I think the market is just if people like the taste or not.
Fair enough. And I guess the question comes then, and I haven't had a chance to research this, what functionally is the difference between making a potato chip versus a corn chip, right? Like, what is the taste profile, the texture profile, which makes one more successful than the other? Can a potato chip carry as much flavor as a corn chip? Is there something to do with the corn paste itself versus a potato? I don't know the answer to those questions, but that would be interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, because the potato chip, I guess, it probably dissolves faster in the mouth for one thing, but that's just because they're super thin.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, again, let's even say out of the chip industry, what if I, this is going to sound disgusting, but what if I took steak and did all the, put on everything that's in a Dorito.
Right.
So I had a Dorito steak.
Well, a steak
like
taco,
I put on tomato
right?
powder.
I'm pretty sure they have steak flavored Doritos. Let me Google that actually. Steak flavored. I wouldn't be shocked if they did steak flavored.
But I'm even thinking a Dorito flavored steak. So I take a steak and I put on tomato powder and green pepper powder and I put in MSG and I put in like, I fry it up and fry it wrapped in cheese. And I wonder if that would be a better tasting steak than regular steak.
Well, let me bring up one last point from Mark Schatzker, who wrote The Doritos Effect. He mentions very specifically that two things have happened. It's not just that more flavoring has come into play in the past half century, as we've shown with Doritos and the junk food industry, but flavor in natural food has gone down. And the reason is this. When you're industrially farming vegetables, say for example, what are you optimizing for? Shelf life, disease resistance, and volume, right? But that actually takes away from the taste, which is why, I mean, you grow a tomato in your backyard, it's going to taste different than an industrial grown tomato. So as the junk food industry and the chemical industry has created more ways to add flavors to food, natural foods have lost flavor. So the reason why I bring all this up is when you're saying, could you Dorito a steak? I would put it this way. If you had a shitty cut of meat, right, that was industrially made, you probably should Dorito that steak. But if you're getting the best cut of meat possible, you know, the one that has not been industrial, it's whatever, grass-fed or Wagyu, it's been beaten up, beaten, I don't want to say in a negative way, but like, you know, it's marbled with all the fats, you're not going to have to add taste, right? Like that thing, like that is...
Right,
like,
it's filled with fat. Yeah. It's great from the fat. I don't know if it's got carbs, but it's certainly got the fat. It's got like this, the flavoring of the cow. So, and like you said, they with Kobe beef, they like feed it beer.
Yeah.
They feed it all these things that are tasty so that you're ultimately, you are what you eat and the cow is what it eats. So that's what you're tasting. I wonder what the most popular or what the best tasting organic food is.
I think, I mean, just from my experiences, having tasted vegetables in Vancouver, like organic farming or backyard farming is very popular here, but I've tasted like small sized tomatoes, onions, kale. It's delicious. It's just, it's not comparable, right? It's just, you can really taste what these vegetables were meant to taste like. And the other part of it that's kind of, if you actually think about it, it's a little bit sickening, is for thousands of years, the only way you could taste an orange was to eat an orange. Now orange is everywhere. You have orange candies, you have orange drinks, you have orange flavored this, orange flavored that. So the specialness of an orange has just been completely diluted by our taste buds, right? And like how we consume food. And I'm not like a super, plant food in your backyard type of individual, but I totally get the sentiment of we're losing a lot of what made dealing with food and enjoyable and what was right about the food industry. It's getting lost. But having said that, you got to balance it out with feeding the world. So there's the other angle.
Yeah, no, that's why I'm always curious about people who are really against genetically modified foods. Like, if you didn't have genetically modified foods, you wouldn't be able to feed an extra 5 billion people that need to be
absolutely
fed. So, and it's not like, I mean, I guess they argue that it's unhealthy, but again, billions of people live very long lives and would have died earlier if they didn't, you know, because they're not starving to death. So, but and also to your point earlier about the market, like, I think the interest in organically grown foods and local foods and, you know, farm to table kind of helps slow down this trend of losing nutrition as we mass feed the population. So I think all these trends are kind of working together to keep us probably as a species healthy enough to survive, but we'll see.
No, absolutely. Well, James, I know that I've read a couple of your works on when you're always looking at the next industries, and vertical farming is something that could very much happen, right? It's like, it's not going to be industrial scale, but individuals being able to create at certain volumes and in a sustainable way, kind of their quote unquote own ingredients. I mean, that's on the roadmap for some places, right? Vertical farming is quite a big thing in the Midwest.
Oh yeah. And also like, taking it one generation further, stem cells that are actual meat, you know, that right. are made into actual meat, but don't come from a cow. So they're right. they're actual cow meat in 100% of the way, but they're completely nutritious because they don't have whatever bad things the cow might have eaten in its life. And but it really is, you know, chemically grown or biologically grown meat. It just doesn't come from a cow.
Yep, absolutely.
So that's going to be a next generation as well. But Trung, thanks so much for enlightening us about Doritos, and come back on the podcast next week and let's figure out another topic to talk about. This is so much fun.
This is a blast.
And I'm gonna Dorito my steak tonight. So we'll see if I could make a steak turned into a Dorito flavoring steak. So we'll see.
Well, perfect. That's a perfect follow up.
So and again, everybody should check out the NIA podcast, not investment advice podcast, by Trung Phan, Phan is the last name, and trungphan.substack.com, or follow him on Twitter. Anything else, anywhere else people should follow
you? Yeah, Trung T Phan is the big one at Twitter. I do want to flag, I'm moving kind of my newsletter over to a company called Workweek, but it'll be the same. It'll be once a week a newsletter. You can still find it. It's all, the Twitter is the easiest place to find everything.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot, Trung, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot, James.